Well, let's see. Lightsabers, Sesame Street, and housing policy. Why, yes, we really do cover everything. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 19th of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, I say every now and then on this program that a single indicator doesn't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy mixed-up economy we live in. And once again today, the business and economic powers that be are proving me right. To wit, the figures from the Commerce Department we told you about last week that retail sales in December, a report that, remember, was delayed by the shutdown, were unexpectedly down. Those retail sales were unexpected because holiday sales, right? Everybody's buying things. It is possible, as we said at the time, that that drop was mostly statistical noise. But today there was some hard evidence that the report of retailing's demise might indeed have been greatly exaggerated. Walmart posted surprisingly strong sales this morning, up 4.2% through the quarter that ended in January. And if you remember that the giant retailer has gone through quite the turnaround the past couple of years, at this point in 2016, Walmart was coming off six straight quarters of flat or declining sales. So it's news. Marketplace's Erica Barris looks into what's driving Walmart's revival.
E-commerce has been a big part of Walmart's recent growth. It was up 43% over the quarter. In its never-ending quest to compete with Amazon, the retailer invested a whole bunch of money in redesigning its website and introducing grocery pickup. And that's helped it boost the average sale per customer visit, Walmart reported. Peter Boatwright teaches marketing at Carnegie Mellon. He says consumers tend to buy non-food items they find in grocery stores. And
Walmart might have started to figure this out in an online setting, where people now, they've invested in the order ahead online, come pick up your groceries. Why not, while you're already on that trip, same thing, same story, get a few other items.
Walmart was also able to grab holiday shoppers now that Toys R Us is gone, and it's gained from its partnership with Lord & Taylor, according to Neil Saunders, an analyst with Global Data.
What it does is add to the core business by allowing Walmart to attract perhaps some demographics that wouldn't usually shop at core Walmart stores.
Walmart has one big advantage over Amazon: thousands of brick-and-mortar stores. It refurbished 500 of them last year. And Saunders says that
just by making those small improvements, they've really got more customers coming into store, and they're getting those customers to spend a little bit more.
And when you're as big as Walmart, a little bit more can add up to a lot more dollars in the register. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
If you are a renter in this economy, this next story is going to sound depressingly familiar. Rents on single-family homes are going up by about 3% nationally last year, which is also, as it happens, about how much average wages grew during that same period before you factor in inflation. And for the fifth year in a row, rents have increased the most, percentage-wise, at the low end of the market. That's all according to a report out today from CoreLogic. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more.
When Brett Wyatt and his husband moved into their two-bedroom, two-bath townhouse in Atlanta 4 years ago, the rent was $1,500 a month. Now it's $1,650.
I would not say our pay has been commensurate with the increase in housing prices, especially in Atlanta.
And that makes it harder for them to keep up with expenses and save to buy a home. Economist Molly Basil at CoreLogic says rents are rising most at the low end of the market by 3.7% a year. On a $1,000 rental, that's almost $450 more over the course of a year.
We have a lot of newly formed households, you know, coming out and most likely looking for rentals at the lower end and really driving up those prices.
Meanwhile, home builders have focused on the higher end of the market where they can make more money. Andrew Orend with the National Low Income Housing Coalition says that leaves more people
doubling up with family members and with friends, constantly moving, and in the worst cases, they wind up becoming homeless.
Landlords feel squeezed, too. AJ Paymaster owns two rentals in the Phoenix area, where rents are rising on average 7% a year, according to CoreLogic. Paymaster says he's been raising the rent about 7 to 8% every 18 months to 2 years.
With wages just not really going up very much on my current job or my wife's job, this is a way for me to actually still keep up with some of the increasing costs overall in our lifestyle.
To hold on to his tenants, he tries to keep his rents slightly below market, but he plans to keep raising them as long as the market allows. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, Dateline China. Rising rents, oh, they are a global phenomenon. Wall Street today, that was fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Karl Lagerfeld died today, as you've heard. He was 85. That's the number the Associated Press is going with. Lagerfeld was the chief designer at Chanel for 36 years. He was the creative director at Fendi as well, and he had his namesake labeled to boot, so he was a busy guy. But more to the point for this program, Lagerfeld in no small way built luxury fashion as we know it today. Christina Binkley has covered fashion for years. It's good to have you on.
I'm glad to be here.
What do you think fashion and the fashion industry would look like today had Karl Lagerfeld not come around?
Oh my God, it's unimaginable. I literally can't even imagine it. He's been such a huge part, both in developing the industry and creating affections for the industry, that it's just inconceivable to imagine what it would be like without him.
Well, so let's get back to that creating the modern fashion industry thing. He went to Chanel 35, 38 something years ago and took what has been described as a moribund company surviving on like perfume and turned it into this $4 billion a year enterprise.
Yeah. And at a time when there really weren't enterprises like that. And when they hired Karl Lagerfeld, he dug into these archives that were decades old and found these items that Coco Chanel had designed for herself and her clients that they're now iconic Chanel, but they were, I think Lagerfeld once laughed back in the 80s that they were only being worn by Parisian doctors' wives. And he meant that as an insult.
Help me understand then how we get from Karl Lagerfeld revitalizing Chanel to a guy who then many, many years later also works with a fast fashion house, H&M, and kind of crosses that divide.
And he did that, I think, in about 2004, yeah, before it became a thing. Now we've been seeing Target collections and H&M collections. If we can take our mindset, we used to think that luxury and fast fashion could never cross the same bridge.
Yeah.
And he loved it. I mean, he took this very strange delight in sort of tickling things that people didn't think should be tickled.
So what happens now to the fashion industry that he's gone? Who replaces him? Who has the name recognition and the brand identity?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Karl Lagerfeld did so much. He was designing three brands, multiple collections, and also had a gazillion side gigs. He clearly had people at each of these brands that were doing a lot of heavy lifting.
Right.
So if you think about Virginie, who's taking over now for him, she may not be. We don't really know her, and she's probably not quite the showman that he was.
Yeah.
So my guess is we're not going to see a lot that's that different in the products. We might not see quite the same showy shows, crazy things like, you know, moving an iceberg from Sweden for a show. And
I read that. You covered him for years. What's your favorite memory?
This is actually one of my most unforgettable moments in ever writing about fashion. I was in Paris and had agreed to meet him and interview him about something he was doing with Fendi. And I went to this address, which turned out to be a tent on the side of the Seine River, and it was raining that day. And he didn't want to go sort of inside and do the cocktail hour thing, so he dragged me outside in the rain. And we stood there with his butler, who was in a tuxedo, and he had a silver tray with a crystal glass of Diet Coke. And Karl and I stood under an umbrella, and this poor fellow stood out in the rain and had the most delightful conversation, which he was really playing hooky for what he was supposed to be doing. It was actually turned out to be a great memory.
Christina Binkley has covered fashion and Karl Lagerfeld for a long time. Christina, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
The The exclusion zone around the Chernobyl nuclear plant that exploded back in April of 1986 reaches across, give or take, 1,000 square miles of northern Ukraine. Towns and villages, whole cities were abandoned and have been almost completely vacant ever since. But some scientists and some residents are calling for parts of that exclusion zone to be reopened. Victoria Gill just spent a week in the zone reporting for the BBC. She sent us this report.
Perhaps the worst accident in the short history of the world's nuclear power industry.
A test of operating systems at Chernobyl nuclear power plant's number 4 reactor went so badly wrong that a steam explosion blew the lid off the reactor. That started a fire that billowed a cloud of radioactive smoke and dust around Europe. Here, that event is etched onto the landscape. More than 4,000 square kilometres spanning Ukraine and Belarus, abandoned.
Where is he?
But in an outer, forgotten part of the exclusion zone, life has continued. Narodichi, a town of more than 2,000 people, is less than 100 kilometres from the power plant.
Раз, два, три.
Tatiana Kravchenko runs the kindergarten here. She remembers the evacuation.
Коли сталася аварія?
When the accident happened, all the children and staff from the kindergarten were evacuated to clean zones. In 3 months, we were sent back. Life went on.
But the future for these children and their families is uncertain. A crucial meeting is set to agree the legal removal of this district from the exclusion zone.
Yes, the exclusion zone's contaminated, but if we would put it on a map of radiation dose worldwide, only the small hotspots would stand out.
Professor Jim Smith from Portsmouth University has been studying this environment since 1990.
Most of the area of the exclusion zone gives rise to lower radiation dose rates than many areas of natural radioactivity worldwide.
When we visit the now dry bed of what was the power station's cooling pond, a dosimeter measuring our hourly radiation dose gives a dramatic demonstration.
So here, standing essentially in the cooling pond of the nuclear power plant, a kilometre from where the nuclear accident happened, we're getting less of an external dose of radiation than on the flight over.
Three times less than what we got on the aeroplane coming over.
Narodichi is one of the least contaminated parts of the zone.
And the objective is to support Ukraine.
Decades of this evidence being presented at the meeting here could lift the town out of the exclusion zone for good and out of the long shadow of the accident.
How did today go, do you think?
We're certainly in agreement here that there needs to be change. So the next step is to communicate with the politicians, tell them what our scientific conclusions are, tell them what the Narodichi district want, and we hope that they will take action.
In the Chernobyl exclusion zone, I'm the BBC's Victoria Gill for Marketplace.
Coming up.
My daughter likes Elmo. He's very popular with four-year-olds.
I know. I mean, who doesn't like Elmo, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 8 points today, less than 0.1%, 25,891. The NASDAQ up 14 points, that's just about 0.2%, 74.86. The S&P 500 advanced 4 points, 0.1%, 27.79. As we reported, Walmart released robust earnings today. Groceries are expanding, more than holding its own in e-commerce. Walmart shares got a boost off the news, up 2.2% today. Told you about Karl Lagerfeld, the privately held luxury brand Chanel that he was chief designer for many, many years. Sold nearly $10 billion in goods in 2017. As I said, they were privately held. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.63%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Venture capital investment in this economy finally topped the peak it hit in the dot-com boom last year. According to the financial data company PitchBook, investors put $130 billion into thousands of companies in 2018, many of which companies most probably aren't going to make it. And some of the ones that go under leave behind a trail of debt. That's what happened with the San Francisco-based food delivery company Munchery, which now owes tens of thousands of dollars to local bakers and chefs. And as Sam Harnett reports from KQED, Munchery's collapse has become a cautionary tale for some other fast-growing startups.
It took almost a decade for Lenora Strada to nurture Three Babes Bake Shop into a business with 19 employees and $1 million in gross sales. She's baked a lot of pies.
These are chocolate pecan pies. And then here we have bourbon pecan pies. We have two kinds of crusts in general.
Strada sells to local restaurants and until recently to Munchery. It sold and delivered prepared food direct to individuals, mostly in urban areas. It made a majority of the food, but also bought some from local bakeries and restaurants. Last Thanksgiving, Munchery ordered 1,000 pies from Estrada, and she baked them all herself.
I actually worked the graveyard shift, and my baby at that time was 2 months old, so I left him at home, and I would work here from 10 p.m. until 8 a.m., just keeping the ovens full.
She says Munchery owed her $20,000 for the order, but the check never came. In mid-January, Munchery closed, and Estrada says the company didn't tell her and other vendors it was shutting down. She says she only found out because she'd once used Munchery as a customer.
I've purchased a sandwich from them before, so I'm now on their listserv. And I received an email from them at the same time as all the other customers of theirs saying that they regretted to inform us that they were closing down.
Munchery started in 2010. Over the last 8 years, it expanded to a handful of major cities, including San Francisco, Seattle, and New York. It raised $125 million in venture capital, which it socked into things like pie orders and advertising.
Munchery's mission is to make real food an easy choice for people who want delicious and healthy meals. Actually,
when the VC money started dwindling in 2017, Munchery began laying off workers and stopping service in some cities. Munchery CEO James Barriker said in an email to Marketplace that he was negotiating for more venture capital this fall, but it didn't come through. He shut down, leaving vendors with debt and customers with useless gift cards. This kind of high-risk, down-to-the-wire gamble is routine in the VC game, says Mara Zepeda.
That's the business model of venture capital.
Zepeda helped begin Zebras Unite, a group formed by entrepreneurs that is critical of venture capital culture. Zebras Unite encourages tech companies to focus on sustainability rather than hyper-fast growth.
Criticizing venture capital for being too high growth is like criticizing fire for being hot.
In his email, Munchery's CEO, Barriker, says he realizes how hard this is for local businesses and that he's working on potential solutions, although he didn't specify what those might be. The venture capital firms that invested in Munchery, Sherpa Capital and Menlo Ventures, declined to comment on what happened with the company. With Munchery now closed, baker Lenora Strada is seeking payment from the venture capitalists. She recently held a bake sale protest outside of Sherpa Capital. Speaking at the protest, she made this demand.
What we want is for the venture capitalists or the investors and board members to take responsibility and write a check for the amount of money that we're owed.
Last year was the first time Estrada was able to offer her workers health care, and she planned on moving into a bigger kitchen. Losing $20,000 means she has to put the expansion on hold. People suggested she run a crowdfunding campaign to recoup her losses. But she says it shouldn't be up to her friends and customers to pay for a venture capital bet that went bust. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Fifty years ago this year, Sesame Street went on the air for the first time, and in short order, became one of this country's most iconic television shows and, not unrelated, eventually a $100 million business. Think licensing deals, lunchboxes, Elmo dolls, all the rest. Marisa Guthrie covers television for The Hollywood Reporter. She took a trip not too long ago out to the show's studios in New York. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First things first, just because it's kind of special television, Sesame Street is. What's it like when you get to go out to the set?
Oh, my goodness. This is going to sound sappy, but it's magical. It really is. Everybody there who works on the show is very friendly, very gracious, very nice, very happy, joking around with each other. They've also, many of them have worked there for a long, long time.
Yeah.
You know, the supervising producer started as an intern.
Wow.
So it really is, does feel like a very, close-knit family when you go there.
Take me back to the beginning, because this, it was almost instantaneously successful.
It was. 50 years ago, when it premiered in November 1969, there was not a lot of television for kids, which is hard to understand, but there just wasn't. And what distinguished Sesame Street was that it was very carefully designed to teach preschool children letters and numbers and socialize them in other ways. So it was really groundbreaking television.
It's interesting because you say in this piece at one point, it demonstrated, and this is early days, right? I mean, it's like, you know, the 60s. It demonstrated what the medium was capable of.
Exactly. Television has always been a very powerful medium. Joan Ganz Cooney, who created, who helped to create Sesame Street, famously said, you know, you can learn from television. It's just a matter of what you're learning. Are you learning garbage or are you going to learn some good stuff, right? And so they decided to try to design a show that could teach kids who did not have access to early childhood education, couldn't afford to go to preschool. This was not something that anybody had really thought to do with television. And it worked, which is incredible.
So bring it forward to today for me, and let's we'll fast forward here. We'll get to the financial crisis where Sesame Workshop and Sesame Street have serious financial difficulties. It is now back and it's on solid ground. I want you to tell me, though, how Sesame Street wound up on HBO instead of PBS, because that was a big deal.
Yeah, the transition from PBS to HBO was a big deal. PBS was only contributing about $4 million a year, and that wasn't even coming close to covering the money they needed to produce the show. And PBS has been under constant assault that its government funding would be zeroed out. And so they needed to find a partner that had more money. I mean, it just came down to that.
It is, as you know, a brave new world in streaming and content and all this stuff. Disney's got its own service coming out. Everybody's streaming everything. Is there a challenge, do you think, to Sesame Street in the kid space, as it were?
The challenge is mostly, I think, for new programs. I think Sesame Street is so iconic, and parents who have preschool age kids who are watching it now, many, many of them, most of them grew up with it. So they know it's something that they can put their kid in front of and they don't have to worry. It's like, you know, you're feeding your kid some broccoli, you know. So, but yes, and no, nothing is guaranteed, right. Even if you've been on 50 years.
Do you have a favorite character?
Well, I like Oscar the Grouch.
I wonder what that says about you. I don't even know.
My daughter likes Elmo. He's very popular with four-year-olds.
Fair enough. Marisa Guthrie covers media and television for The Hollywood Reporter. Marisa, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, here's another entertainment anniversary story, film this time, not television. The movie Office Space turns 20 today, and for a generation, that movie captured the drudgery of the white-collar workplace and the daily indignities suffered by cubicle dwellers across the land. So from his not at all Office Space-like offices in New York, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has a look at how that film changed the way we think about work.
Yeah, so if you haven't seen Office Space, I'm going to need you to go ahead and watch it. Thanks. No, really, it's good. It follows some workers at a software company who basically hate their jobs. And it's not just that Office Space captured the emptiness of some workplaces. It's that it was just so spot on in doing so.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS reports.
I think Office Space is probably the most influential movie as it relates to how we think about workplace culture. Primarily because its humor was so relatable.
Susan Lamott is CEO of Exaquio, an employer brand and talent consultancy. Office Space's workplaces are full of unempathetic and incompetent bosses. The work appears meaningless. Expectations are unclear. One of the enduring lessons of the film was that employees who are not fulfilled are often not productive.
It's not that I'm lazy. It's that I just don't care.
Increasingly, companies have warmed up to the importance of making employees feel valued and invested in their jobs. Arthur Woods is co-founder of Imperative, a startup that's done a lot of research on workplace engagement.
People are seeking fulfillment in their work today more than ever before. Only about 1% of the population today believes they can be fulfilled in life without being fulfilled in work.
If employees don't get some kind of fulfillment from their work, they can leave.
If you look at Office Space, it's a case study of what not to do.
But as much as some places are aware of this, many are not, which is why Office Space remains so relevant. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Never saw Office Space. Don't at me. All right, this final note on the way out today, which I kind of love, from the Associated Press, this item, lightsaber fencing. The AP reports the International Fencing Federation, that sport's governing body, says it is, quote, interested in how this new event progresses, that is to say, lightsaber fencing. It seems the French Fencing Federation, to get more kids off the couch and into the gym, are giving fencing clubs lightsabers, and they are training lightsaber instructors. Here's the quote from the Federation's Secretary General. With young people today, he said, it's a real public health issue. They don't do any sport and only exercise with their thumbs, end of quote. One does wonder, though, if those lightsabers, are they going to make the noise or what? All right, we're done. The Dow today basically flat. The NASDAQ up 14 points, just under 0.2%. The S&P 500 up about 4 points. That's about 0.1%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Bion, Danielle Chiriguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.